Well, we come to an anticipated section in Isaiah, which I have put off almost for 6 weeks, not because I didn't want to do it, but I just wanted to do it and keep on going. And so today is the day we're going to move on in Isaiah chapter 40. Even though this is going on in Isaiah, still this introduction to 40, because anytime you study the scripture, the better understanding you have of the context or the setting of the text, the easier it is to understand what the text is saying. So I want to lay for you again, using the first verses in Isaiah 40, to lay that foundation. And that foundation I actually have written on the board behind me before you. So rather than tell you what I'm going to tell you, I'm going to just tell you what I'm going to tell you. So we're doing the detective work. We know all about that, looking for eschatological evidences in Isaiah. So I say, at long last, we come to Isaiah 40, the glory phase of the Lord's plan for the ages, the eschaton. And that's my map up here. There's a plan for the ages. The whole thing is God's plan for the ages. There's nothing in here that's added. It was there in the beginning, and it continues to the end. So in that plan, we have the Eden Garden creation. We have the fall of Adam and Eve. We have the judgment of the garden, expelling from the garden. We have the flood judgment on the earth, which we see still today in stark array with mountains and rivers and oceans. And then we have this world that is under judgment, under which we have lived. Humanity has basically lived since Adam and Eve. And we find that in this world under judgment, there is also the redemption provided in the cross. And it's in the world in judgment. Now it's a matter of waiting for this all to work out. And we're in that waiting period. I had to put a blank spot up here. But before the recreation, there is a rescue. We call it the rapture. I like to use rescue because that is actually what happens when people don't understand what rapture is. There is a recreation, I think, that happens already in the tribulation and goes on into up to the second advent, where the world is made new. And then we have the restoration world, and it is the glory of God in the eschaton. So when I say the glory phase of God's plan, that's what I mean, is the glory phase of this plan. There's glory all the way along, no doubt about that. But there will be no glory as great as the glory that is here in the eschaton. The shift to the major section of the book is so dramatic from 39 to 40 that scoffers have postulated that it is another author. Some even suggest three such divisions in the book. Not so. The book has a striking, marvelous, and humbling unity. Remember, Isaiah must be a compilation of the histories and prophecies assembled in the book carrying his name. I don't know how that came about, whether Isaiah actually did it or there were people that did it for him or after Isaiah when it was done, but it does carry his name. And these words are the words of Isaiah. These are the words of God that Isaiah has spoken or wrote, written. In the big picture, Isaiah is the account of the salvation of Israel. But maybe not so surprising to us, as we reflect on these opening verses, we cannot help but recount our personal salvation experiences with God who has saved us. If Israel is to be confronted, Isaiah 40 verse 1, we too can identify with the same comfort because our sins have been forgiven as our warfare against our Maker has ended. Now, we don't have a complete salvation yet, because we talk about you were saved from your sin and you're going to be saved from the presence of sin later. So we don't claim the redemption totally that Isaiah 40 talks about for Israel. So our redemption is in stages. Our bodies are not yet redeemed. So these opening verses in Isaiah 40 are in the voice of God. Here we might think of the thundering voice at Mount Sinai as God spoke directly to his people. But here again we have the voice of God in written text, just as authoritative as if spoken audibly. This is clearly so because the section ends with, "For the mouth of the Lord has spoken it." So how can we read these words with the striking majesty of God's voice? It all seems so inadequate. But the text must be read. We cannot duplicate the voice of God. We can offer up the finest of human voices to read the poetic text. And it is poetry, by the way. Not everyone appreciates the operatic tenor voice, but in my estimation, it alone approximates the voice of God and it demands our attention. So rather than read the text to you, we offer the text in a dramatic music form. This lasts about 7 minutes and is posed by George Handel in The Messiah, an oratorio. Now, interesting, all of those things that are talked about in those five verses happen at the second advent and following. And that's why it ends up on the glory of God, and all flesh will see it together. And that's in the kingdom, in the glory kingdom, in the eschaton. It doesn't happen out here in the sense it happens here. So how it goes, the first phrase is this, comfort ye, and it does it twice. Comfort ye, comfort ye. And that's at the second coming. There is no comfort for Israel now. By application, we apply it to ourselves, but we still have an incomplete salvation because our bodies are not redeemed. So the comfort is at the second advent, not before. At the second advent is where the warfare with God and Israel, or Israel with God, has ended. And it is there that their iniquity will be pardoned, because it is at that point there is a nationwide pardoning at the end of the tribulation. The third phrase, or the third section, at the second coming, there is the ending of resistance. They will make straight the pathway for our God, that is the conversion of souls. Here it's a statement about all Israel will be saved. And that's what John the Baptist was trying to say when he announced Jesus to the people, that make way in your life for this Messiah. And of course, they didn't. Now, the controversial aspect probably is the next phrase, where it says at the second coming. I think it's at the second coming. It says that every valley will be exalted and every hill may be made low. And if we're listening to what I've been teaching to you, this is the same language that we get of Revelation chapter 6 through 19, 6 through 18, actually, 19 to second advent. The valley will be exalted, every hill will be low. This is the restoration aspect of this plan of God, 2 Peter 3, Revelation 6 through 18. Because it does say in Revelation that the hills are lowered and the valleys are raised. In fact, the islands even disappear. And we have Revelation 21:1. It says even the sea disappears. And I found a great verse in Isaiah that actually says that same thing. We've always wondered, what in the world does no sea mean? Isaiah tells us what it means. So then we have at the second coming, the glory of God will be revealed, obviously. So it's the glory in the eschaton, the messianic eternal kingdom. And now here is something that has been prophesied in, even in the New Testament, that all knees will bow. And so here we have that all flesh will see it together. All flesh will see it together. This is human beings seeing this. And it says in Philippians even, it says that every knee shall bow. Well, this is the place where that occurs. So with all this said now, the question about authority is stated again. So it ends up this little section with, the mouth of the Lord has spoken it, which is to say it surely will happen. So here we have five verses, basically the ending of all things. Let's keep on working through this. So we have in these five verses the entire restoration of Eden, starting with Eden here. This includes the redemption of the people and nature, the world, the habitat for humanity and its creatures. We don't think of a salvation just for the individual, it's also for the entire creation that's been under judgment, under these two judgments we have here. These verses in Isaiah are not figurative. Too quickly, there is a temptation to force these verses on the returning Jews from Babylon, but that demands hyperbole, exaggeration, and unnecessary over-figurative speech, if not allegory. Now, of course, John the Baptist cites this one verse, making the pathway straight, challenging the Jews to welcome Jesus, their Messiah. And we have no reason to make something else of these real hills and mountains, valleys and plains. They're not figurative of something. They're the actual hills, valleys, and plains. We know that from Revelation. There is a reordering of the earth's surface. Now, we say that is such a huge thing. You go outside and see the mountains out there so majestic and they're so wonderful, they're so pretty with snow on them. But remember the statements of judgment. And we think that's a big thing that God reordered that. But then think about it, something much greater than that is our own salvation provided by his son. So we don't want to be caught up. How could God do this? Well, that's one thing we learn about in eschatology. We find how great God is. And the thing we can't understand how God could actually do, God actually does, and that makes God bigger, and that gives glory to God, which is where we're going with all this. So the stage is set, so we can draw clear parallels, us personally, in the church age, between Israel and our Christian experience. That is why so many verses in Isaiah are committed to our memory. Isaiah 53, 6, and so forth. We think of all verses in Isaiah, and sometimes we don't know for sure where they come from, but they are in Isaiah, and they're written to Israel, but they're applicable to us in an application way. So the stage is set for the redemption of Israel in these last chapters. We will use Andy Woods' observation last week that peace follows judgment. We will see this in the makeup of Isaiah. To finish the 360-degree cycle, the whole loop, we have disobedience precedes judgment, and therefore we have peace. Therefore, we would characterize chapters 1 through 39 as God's warning, and intermixed with this warning is Israel's lament, because they don't like to be warned. They woe is me laments type thing under God's judgment. And these are the major themes in the first 39 chapters. And the Lord's restoration is on a minor theme in these first 39 chapters. This is contrasted with a reversal of emphasis from 40 through 66, rest of the book, where restoration is the major theme and the warnings and the laments are the minor. So always have both in each half. It's a matter of how they're emphasized. As you said last week, the history of the book is necessary to set times and the conditions of the prophecy, and loosely B.C. 750 to 680 in that neighborhood. But the unparalleled value is in its prophetic contribution, not in its historic. While the historic is foundational, it is not as important as the prophetic contribution of the Old Testament. And we find that after Isaiah is written, that there are other, we call them the minor prophets, particularly, continue to cite Isaiah, not directly, but allusions to Isaiah. So Isaiah becomes a foundational prophetic book in the Old Testament. So recapping, Isaiah covers the times and the threats of the conquest of Assyria over the northern tribes, 721, and the prophetic, not yet happened, threat of a Babylon with its conquest of Judah in the south, 605-586. After 7 years, Israel, whatever now Israel, Judah, and we're going to call them Israel from now on, is returned to the land by Cyrus the Great starting around 539. Well, since the Judean exile was to a single nation, Babylon, and since many or most of them never returned to the land, remember only 50,000 returned, they're subsequently considered Jews in a diaspora. And if you go over to Iran today, you will still find Jews there, even with all the persecution there have been. In all the area that was Persia, you will still find Jews, even today. Now, at the time of Jesus, some of these returned to Jerusalem for Passover, and then at the time of the church, they came for Pentecost, and they spoke from these different languages. But the scriptures reveal that the Jews will be scattered through the whole world amongst many nations, and that will occur, and we know that by history, they occurred after 70 AD and was finally completed 135, which is, I think, the second diaspora, and I would think as the Bible talks about it from the New Testament standpoint, it's the real diaspora in the prophetic sense. Maybe all the diaspora gets melded into one. Those who see no prophetic sense in Isaiah quickly move these passages, the return from Babylon and the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the rebuilding of the temple, the obedience of the people, as completely satisfied in the return from the Babylonian exile. That's how they see those verses we just read. They're just history. Even history does not match, but if you try to put this together, it doesn't match at all. The people certainly aren't obedient, and the temple surely isn't everlasting because it was destroyed in 70 AD. So this is for, and when you do this, this forces a late date on Isaiah, so Isaiah didn't write the book at all. So we have all kinds of trouble here, so I say it's not the right camp to be in. Now the disdain for the supernatural, that is the Jewish hope, drives a false conclusion of these first chapter verses to apply these to Babylon. So unclearly indicated, this is our rule, unless clearly indicated, in other words, by names and places and certain things that cannot be disputed, we take the passages outlined in Isaiah 41 through 5 as literal, and we have the full return to the land of the diaspora, to the land by the diaspora. We have the rebuilding of the temple, whether it's by God or by human. I think in the end it'll be rebuilt by the Lord. It's a new temple. And New Jerusalem, which John talks about in John chapter 14, also John talks about in Revelation 21:1. And the obedience of the people, which comes out of the Abrahamic covenant, people will actually be obedient to God. And all of them under the reign of the Messianic King who will return to earth having restored it as the new Garden of Eden or better. That's what we get when we read it literally. Therefore, our exegetical task is quite simple. Take the text in a literal sense and always expect it to be prophetic. Always expect it to be prophetic unless the text makes it impossible to do so. Like with Cyrus the Great, I have here an example of that. We won't stop to read it. Now, to introduce these chapters, I'm going to use the words of Gary Smith, who happens to agree with me, or I agree with him, however you want to do it, on this pattern we have set up here. So it's interesting how he puts this, and he does it more eloquently than I could, and he does a nice job here. Let me explain what he's saying. The message of Isaiah 40-66 is above all else a word of comfort and good news. It offers hope for both the person who is weary because of the trials of life, for the person who may think that God has forgotten about him. See, that's the application of Isaiah to our life. We do it easily. These oracles of salvation offer God's strength because God is near to help and able to deliver his people from danger. And my point, how easy it is to appropriate the truth of God's redeeming grace to our own lives. Grace is the same. Although God may seem to be far away at times, he never forgets his children and always is attentive to hear and answer their prayers. He is a God who is powerful because he has a strong arm and can overcome any obstacles. The major political, economic problems of this world, and we see many, amount to nothing in his eyes because he is able to direct the course of history. We get this from Isaiah. Thus, the challenge is for every believer to gain an authentic understanding of just how great God is. He is the creator of the heavens and the earth, and we'll have a whole chapter on that. And the one who knows the name of every star, the one who controls the rise and fall of nations and their leaders, the compassionate redeemer of his people, the Holy One and the King, metaphorically used here, of the universe. Once a person begins to catch Isaiah's vision of parable power and his wonderful plans for this world, we can begin to rest in the knowledge that God can give each person who trusts in him the ability to overcome every threat and victoriously endure every challenge. That's the application for us. So this is the payoff of studying eschatology. It is good for our daily living. It elevates the greatness of our God because we see it in the eschaton. We see it in the eschatology. The prophecies of chapters 40-66 do not predict that there will be no problems. In fact, the lives of the Israelites addressed in these oracles were full of problems. Some fell into sin and worshiped pagan gods. Some were rebellious, stubborn so that they did not follow God's direction. Others prayed at pagan high places, offered useless sacrifices that did not honor God. Sin always causes separation from God and usually results in some much-needed divine discipline. But God has revealed in these prophecies the good news that his chosen servant will bring into existence a new world of justice for people in every nation and make possible a new covenant relationship with God. This servant will suffer for the sins of others, bear the guilt of their sins, take on himself the punishment of these sinners deserved. This servant will be exalted for his work and will exalt all those who confess their sins and follow the path of the suffering servant. Another part of this good news is found in the series of salvation proclamations about God's preparation for a glorious city in Zion, over here on the left here, or your right, where he will dwell in all his glory. He will bring all his servants to this wonderful place so that he can glorify God for the rest of eternity. People from all the nations of the earth will flock to Zion to join the millions of others praising God and glorifying his name. This will be a wonderful time when all the people of earth will be holy, that is not necessarily righteous, but they're set apart, they're living a righteous life. There will be no sorrow, shame, there will be peace on the earth. If this sounds like an inviting place to be, then it would be wise to spend some time reading the book of Isaiah to hear about all the details that are explained in these prophecies. These prophetic words are written to inform and to persuade people to join the millions who will be joining the most fulfilling experience that will be greater than anything they have ever imagined. Once people understand how great God is and what he plans to do for his people, many will want, I hope, by God's grace, confess their sins and be forgiven. Then they confidently know that they will one day live in that holy city with God because their future destiny is secure. Although God's marvelous thoughts and ways are far above and beyond any of our thoughts, we've got to be careful we don't get our thoughts in there, God has given a glimpse of some of his thoughts in the prophecies of the book of Isaiah. It is a breathtaking story with unbelievably tragic failures by the enemies of God, but it also has a fantastic ending for those who love and serve God. The heights of God's wrath are illustrated as he tramples the wicked in his anger, but his tender love is illustrated by comparing him to the shepherd who gently carries his lambs to safety. These oracles record the preaching of a prophet who might be called the Old Testament evangelist. He gives his audience two choices: either glorify God and enjoy life in his presence forever, or reject him, end up in that other terrible place where the fire never goes out and the worm never dies. In the preface to Volume 1, which deals with Isaiah 1 through 39, I compared the writing of this commentary to the challenges of climbing Mount Everest. And I was really kind of glad to hear that here's a guy that is studying the book of Isaiah and teaching it or writing on it at the same time. And I've always felt so guilty that I have to teach you the Isaiah while I'm studying it rather than have studied it and then come teach it to you. So he apparently in the same boat I am. Maybe we never get to the bottom of any of these studies, and so we can never get finished with the studies, and we have to start someplace and then start writing. And that's what I think he's done. So I compared the writing of this commentary to challenges of climbing Mount Everest. At that time, I thought I knew the terrain of the mountain and many of the dangers of the trek. He said, I thought I knew. But as I have climbed to even higher peaks in chapter 40 and 66, I realized again how difficult this journey is. And you've been on it with me. There are many contradictory opinions on which path to take, and so many different interpretations of evidence within these prophecies that a person sometimes wonders which way to go. We really can't know. Now, in his commentary, he engages a lot with people that we wouldn't even spend any time dealing with. Commentators do that. You know, people say things that we know they're totally off, and he's got to cite them because it's part of their response to this particular passage. So it makes the commentary longer, I think, than it needs to be. But anyway, so he's probably referring to all of those and probably to others as well that it doesn't refer to. He goes on, to be safe, it is sometimes easier to follow the path of great men. Here I put in the big men that we have in our dispensational pantheon. Follow the path of great men who have blazed the trail through Isaiah in past. But there are from time to time opportunities to blaze some new trails where few have ventured. That's what we've been doing. I have learned much from the mistakes and the wisdom of past travelers through Isaiah, especially the great Dutch commentator. I don't know who he is. Cool. But I have tried also to lay down some new trails for readers to examine, evaluate, and follow. Some will no doubt be rightly skeptical of these new trails, want to keep to the security of the old paths. But I invite all who read this commentary to expand their imagination about what the prophecies might be saying or what actually are saying. I pray that some will offer additional evidence to enhance the perspective of these new paths, that some will correct ideas where mistakes were made, so that the truth that God was sharing through his prophets will ultimately cause the light of God's word to shine more brilliantly to the world that needs to hear good news for a change. So this is my autobiographical part. I identify what he just said. So we too have been climbing Mount Everest and find that the climb is not only scary, but it's also rewarding. How is it that so many have followed the wrong trail and end with another world's heaven in an unknown place, the classical view? In another world's heaven in an unknown place. We are arguing against that. We know exactly where we're going. We know what it's going to be like. Except we can't describe it completely because it is in a different, I'd call it different phase, but different, after the recreation, how can you tell what it's going to be like? But it is our place. Yet it is possible for error to gain the persona of truth, and that is something we always have to watch, something that hangs around so long it becomes like the truth. And so I'm thinking about our Lutheran friends across the road, just as infant baptism in the mind of a believing Lutheran, and I think there are some, they can't shake somehow the baptism of children, of babies. So what is the safe haven for us? Well, the literal word, the literal sense of the word is our safe haven. And that's what I've been driving. In all my studies, I've been driving towards the literalness of the word, the literalness of the word. Stay away from the figurative. Don't allow figures to drop in and change meaning. So here we find our security and ultimate comfort in spite of the crosswinds that blow from church history. Church history has set us up for a fall. The study of Isaiah, the salvation of Israel, is now before us.